Good evening, everyone. This is such an exciting event tonight. We're going to talk to a real bookman, Charlie Leavitt, who's written a number of books that really convey his love of books, his love of reading, and his scholarship. And hosting him tonight is Fiona Davis, whose most recent book, The Lions of Fifth Avenue, is an ode in part to the New York Public Library. So for my brief commercial break, we have sold out of Fiona's book twice now, but we can reorder it. And Fiona said she might send us some signed book plates, so that would be really cool. Charlie's book has not yet arrived, and this is my advanced reading copy, but Charlie is signing our copies of Escaping Dreamland, which is our fantastic fiction book pick for September. But Charlie, if they don't show up pretty soon, it may be our pick for October. Oh, well. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to this. And I want to encourage any of you watching this to think about books that you read as a child that maybe had a big impact on, well, not maybe, that actually did have a major impact on your own reading life. And you can send those comments into Facebook and we'll go over them in like 30 minutes or so, because it's fun to find out what people read that really have stayed with them all their lives. And on that note, Fiona, you're the host, so I'm going to sit back here and let you talk to Charlie.
Sure. Well, welcome everybody, and thank you, Charlie, for doing this. I'm very excited to talk to you about your book, which comes out on Tuesday. Is that right? September 22nd. Yeah. And just to hear some of the wonderful things that have been said about this book already, Liza Nash Taylor said, "Leavitt navigates skillfully between centuries while exploring interwoven themes of regret, unrequited love, loyalty, and ambition. Not since E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime has this era in New York been so beautifully captured." And I think that sums it up perfectly. So to start, can you just give us a kind of a summary of what this book is about?
Sure. Well, this book for me was inspired by those children's series books that I read as a child that really were the first books that got me super excited about writing. You know, I had written books about Shakespeare and Jane Austen, and I thought, yeah, that's all well and good, but that's not what I read when I was a kid. What I read was this. I read the Hardy Boys in these blue covers, you know, and so I wanted to kind of explore that world, and I knew a little bit about it. Enough to know that there were some intriguing things about it. So Escaping Dreamland ended up being a novel about four writers who live in New York City. One in 2010 who's sort of just had his breakthrough novel, but is having issues with both his career and his personal life because of some demons he has in the past that are connected to his love of these children's series books. And then the other three writers are three young people in the 1906 in New York City, trying to sort of make their way in this new century, in this amazing city, and they're all interested in writing books for children, and they end up working together on these series books. And so the book is about, every time I read it, I think it's about something different, but it's about the way that these stories echo down through the centuries and the unexpected ways that the lives of these four people are intertwined with each other. You know, recently a reviewer pointed out to me, it's also a book about how we recover after tragedy. All four of the main characters have some sort of tragic event in their past. And that seems suddenly has taken on, you know, a new meaning. When I was working on it, I thought it was a book about identity. So that was another theme that came up, but really, you know, if you love New York, if you love children's series books, that's kind of what it's about.
And I think that's the sign of a great book, is that it changes every time you read it, you know, and what stands out to you or the significance of it changes with each reading. And so you talked about your inspiration were these children's books. Can you go into that a little bit more? I'm curious to hear more about the inspiration Sure. behind the book.
So, you know, I'd grown up reading my brother's copies of the Hardy Boys, and I'd seen friends read, you know, Nancy Drew and Tom Swift and then in the 1980s, I was an antiquarian bookseller specializing in children's books, and this book came across the threshold that was the autobiography of a guy named Leslie McFarlane, and it said that he had written the first 12 Hardy Boys books. And I thought, well, no, Franklin W. Dixon wrote the Hardy Boys books. Everybody knows that. His name is right here on the cover. It says so, you know. And that was when I discovered that Carolyn Keene, the so-called author of Nancy Drew and Franklin W. Dixon, didn't exist. And then all of these not every children's series books, but the most successful ones had been created by a guy named Edward Stratemeyer, who did write some books, but for many books, he would come up with the idea for the series, come up with the characters, and then he would write an outline for each book and send those outlines to ghostwriters and pay them a flat fee to write the book. So Leslie McFarlane had taken his outlines and written Hardy Boys books for a fee of, I don't know, I think it was something like $125, $150 a book, which at the time was good money for what he was doing. But if he had taken a 1% royalty instead, he might have done pretty well, you know. So I just thought this was fascinating. And people still come to me. I had an email from a guy today who goes, oh, I bet Franklin W. Dixon was mad when they changed the covers of his books. And I was like, well, no, he wasn't, because he didn't exist. So to me, that was an intriguing thing, that so many of us looked up to these authors, and then I found out they didn't exist. I thought, I gotta put that in a book someplace. So that was one of the hooks that sort of drew me in. Oh no.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
Did I lose you?
Yeah, I can still hear you, but I'm not sure what happened here.
We can see you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll keep talking then.
Okay. I love what you were talking about, because it really is kind of a Wizard of Oz effect of what's behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And revealing that. And then you talk about the theme of identity in Escaping Dreamland. And what inspired that exploration?
Well, I mean, I think it was a lot of things. Part of it, I think, was in my own personal life. I have a daughter who lives in New York City, in the greatest city in the world, who's non-binary. And, you know, not coming to terms with that, but coming to understand what that meant for me, was a really interesting and informative journey, and it made me understand levels of identity that I hadn't really thought about before. And so when I was writing about these characters, I realized that I could play with those levels. And so, you know, Magna, for instance, one of the writers from 1906, she has her real name is Magda Herzenberger. When she tries to sort of assimilate herself into America, she calls herself Mary Stone. Then when she disguises herself as a man to try to get a job, she calls herself Marcus Stone. And then when she writes this book, she has a pseudonym for that. So she has four different names in the book. And it's sort of, to me, indicative of these layers of identity that we sometimes feel like we have to wear in order to fit in at a particular time in a particular place.
Yes. And I have to say, she's one of my favorite characters in it. I just adored her and her journey. And one of the things you do is, as a writer of historical fiction, I love reading books set in old New York City. And you did the 1906 time period so beautifully. What attracted you to that year specifically in terms of the kind of starting up that storyline?
So when I thought about, you know, children's series books, and I got interested in that, and I'd read the Hardy Boys, but I knew there were like scores of other series that I hadn't read. And I thought, well, maybe I could find one. And then I realized, wait a minute, I have some. I have a little shelf of books that belonged to my grandfather when he was a little boy. And some of them, this is one of them, but some of them were, and if you look inside here, you can see his little boy book plate, you know.
Yes. So
these are called the Great Marvel books. And so I pulled one of them off the shelf and I started reading it. I looked at the back of the title page and it said copyright 1906. And so that was, you know, that immediately sort of drew me to 1906. And then, you know, the only thing I knew, if you said what happened in 1906, the only thing I can come up with personally was, oh, well, that was a San Francisco earthquake.
Yeah.
So that had to go in the book for sure. But then I started researching New York City, because I knew that was the center of publishing, New York City around that time period. And it was just fascinating, all the different historical events that I knew nothing about, but that played into the narrative, I thought, in such an interesting way. And so to me, that it just became the perfect place and time, you know, to set the book. And also, I felt like being at the beginning of a new century, there was this sense, as I read the papers from the time period, that anything was possible, that the world was this wide open place, just waiting for us. And I don't know that sense lasted after, you know, the First World War and things. So it was a very interesting time to to explore in a fictional way.
And your research is really impeccable, and you cover a lot of ground. How did you go about that? Did you go to kind of original sources? Did you go through the New York Times archives? Did you talk to historians? What was your research process?
So, you know, in the past, sometimes my research process is going to the place. I really like going to the place. And of course, I had been to New York City a lot. And I did, Jimmy and I took a whole day in the Lower East Side and walked around to places where Magda had lived. And we walked down 23rd Street and found her apartment building, you know. But unlike some of the historical novels I've written in the past, I mean, my one right before this, The Lost Book of the Grail, was set in a medieval cathedral. And in there, I could just go and sit in a medieval cathedral. They're still around, you know. 1906 New York is not still around. There are individual buildings and spots where you can see remnants of it. But as far as, you know, the sounds and the sights and the smells, and just the feel of walking down the street in 1906 in New York, it's gone. And so I had to be a little more imaginative in the research. So newspapers were a big part of it. I really felt like, although I did read some history books, I felt like newspapers are so much more immediate, and they use the language of the era, and you get to hear people quoted, you know, talking about what they've seen and what they've done. And so I used a lot of different newspaper archives, especially the one at the Library of Congress, and newspapers.com, which does include the New York Times and others. And then also the New York Public Library and the New York Historical Society both have great digitized collections, because I couldn't really spend all my time in New York. And I mean, I used everything from, there were these fantastic atlases that they made for the fire department that literally have building by building, you know, this is such and such a hotel, and this is such and such a store. And you know, I printed out 23rd Street and posted it up on my wall and marked, like, okay, this is where Dutton's was, and this is where Magda's apartment was, and so on and so forth. And so those were great, but also city directories. I mean, almost all of the names of characters came out of city directories of the time period. Everything down to menus, you know, when they're going to go to Child's restaurant, the New York Public Library has a menu collection, and I found a menu from Child's so that they could eat the food that they would have eaten at that restaurant in 1906. So a lot of it was, rather than necessarily history books, it was more looking at everyday items, you know, photographs, ticket stubs, newspapers. I found this, this amazing, this was one of the few things I bought on eBay for this book. This was a ticket on the Iron Steamboat Company to Dreamland from 1906.
Wow.
So when you get your signed books, I made a little stamp out of the ticket stub. So you'll get a stamp with your Dreamland ticket on your book. And then postcards are great. This was the postcard I found of Dreamland that ended up being the cover of the book.
Yes.
So just a lot of those ordinary objects became really important to me. And I feel like they just, that I always like to write about the history of ordinary people. There's a lot of, you know, sort of celebrity cameos in this book, but it's not a book that's about William Howard Taft or Orville Wright or Stanford White or all these other people who show up on the stage briefly. It's about people who are not celebrities, who are ordinary people living their ordinary lives, as most of us are. And so to me, those daily artifacts like newspapers and magazines became really the most important sources. And even looking at newspapers and magazines, sometimes I found the advertisements were as useful, if not more useful, than the articles themselves.
Yes, because they show what's going on and what's in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, and it also, you know, advertisers have to know the way people think. And so if you want to know how somebody thought in 1906, look at the way things got marketed to them, you know. And I just find that fascinating.
The other great thing
about the historical research is how many times, and this is more with this book than any other book that I've ever done, how many times I would set out to try to find out something, and the thing that I found out that was true was so much more apt for my narrative than what I was imagining. I'll just give you one example. I thought it'd be nice if Magda and her friend Jean, one of the other writers from 1906, if they're walking down the street at Christmas time, looking at the windows in the stores. And first I had to find out, did they even have store window displays in 1906? And where in New York were they? Well, not only did they have one, but then I found out there was one in 1906. This is a few months after the big scene in the novel that happens at the Dreamland amusement park. There's a store window that for the Christmas window, they recreated Dreamland in miniature in the store window. I'm like, how does that happen? How can something that perfect for your novel just pop up in the newspaper? You know, so that's one of the things I love about the research is those moments when the history takes over and tells you where to go.
That is incredible. How long does it take you to research before you start your first draft? Or do you do it at kind of ongoing?
Well, it's sort of both. So I do sort of deep background. So the deep background for this book was reading a bunch of children's series books of the time period, reading about Stratemeyer, Edward Stratemeyer and his syndicate and the way that he did things, reading more broadly about the history of New York. And when I realized that I wanted to have Coney Island be a big part of it, you know, reading about Coney Island. So just sort of broad learning about the period a little bit. And then maybe in the course of that, finding some of these major events like the earthquake or the General Slocum disaster, you know, that I knew were going to be sort of points along my continuum as I worked on the novel. So that's kind of stage one. And then at that time, I also work on character sketches and trying to get to know my characters. And then there's a different type of research that happens when I'm actually working on a draft and you're going along and you say, okay, Magna needs to go from, you know, 23rd Street to down to Trinity Church, Wall Street. How does she get there? You know, what type of public transportation is it? Where does it go? Does she have to change trains? Does she get on a trolley car? You know, so a lot of those kind of things I would work out sort of in the moment. And so, some days you wouldn't get very much work done because you spent 4 hours trying to find out how much it cost to ride the L in 1906, you know, things like that. So.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that your book offers is a really unique perspective into what it was like to be gay in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, was that difficult to research considering how secretive gay lifestyles were back then? And how did you go about that? Because it's such a heartbreaking part of the story. It's really beautiful.
So the character Gene Pinkney is what we would call today gay, although he would not have used that word in the early 20th century. And I knew I wanted him to be gay. And I also knew it was going to be hard to figure out what that meant. I mean, I talked with Rebecca Mackay on my podcast about her book, The Great Believers, mm-hmm. which is set in Chicago in the 1980s. And even there, it was, you know, marginalized communities don't make it into the history books. And so it can be very difficult to research. So I called Jimmy, my child in New York, and I said, look, you just got out of college. You did queer studies. What do I do? And Jimmy said, you've got to read this book called Gay New York. And it's in the acknowledgments of the book. Cause I don't remember the author off the top of my head. And it goes from like 1890 to I think the 1950s or 60s. But I read the first three or four chapters of that book over and over and over and over again. And every time a place was mentioned, I would go and search the newspaper archives and read everything I could about that particular place that, you know, and that was really helpful because the language was different. The notion of what homosexuality was different. Mm-hmm. And the ways that it was expressed were different. And in some ways it was a society where it was probably easier to be gay in 1906 in New York than in 1956 in New York, you know, but it was very different. And so that, again, it opened up this whole world to me that I knew nothing about and was fascinated by. And it really allowed the character of Gene to develop as I started to understand what it meant to be someone like him in that particular time period.
Right, Fiona, could I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
I looked up the acknowledgments since I happen to have this book right here. his name is George Chauncey.
Right.
George Chauncey, and the book is called Gay New York, Gender, Urban Culture, and the Making of the Gay Male World, 1890 to 1940. And then you also recommend A Crack in the Edge of the World by Simon Winchester, who has written a number of great historical books. I wanted to ask you a couple questions that maybe Fiona was, but let me just carry on here for a moment. You needed some kind of a tragedy in order to make your 1906 story work. Did you know, I don't want to really give away which one it was. Did you know about that particular event that you ended up using, or did you come upon the event and then you were able to work it into the narrative? Which way did it go?
Because the event I think you're talking about happens pretty early in the book, I'll go ahead and talk about it. So as I started researching the time period, it's when I discovered about the General Slocum disaster. It was actually 2 years early. It was 1904, but I thought, well, that's close enough because my characters are going to have these tragedies in their past. So that's 2 years in the past for Magda. And in 1904, an excursion boat called the General Slocum left for a church picnic, basically, mostly women and children from a German church on the Lower East Side. And it started steaming up the East River and it caught fire. And the captain grounded it on the edge of something called North Brother Island, which at the time was an island that was used as a hospital island for infectious diseases. And now it's just, it's a wildlife sanctuary. You can't even go on to North Brother Island. And by the time all the smoke had cleared and everything, over 1,000 people had lost their lives. Mm-hmm. It was the largest single loss of life in New York City prior to 9/11. And yet, in my experience talking to people about this, very few Americans have ever heard of it. And it took a community on the Lower East Side, which before this event was the largest urban population of Germans outside of Berlin. I mean, it went like Berlin, the Lower East Side of New York, and then, you know, Hamburg, Munich, so on and so forth. And it more or less destroyed the community because almost everyone in that community lost a family member. And eventually they moved up to the Upper East Side to Yorkville. And the next wave of immigrants came into the Lower East Side. And so I just found that heartbreaking and fascinating, the ways in which that tragedy affected people on a very personal level, but also helped shape New York City. Even the New York City as we know it today was shaped in part by that event that took place, almost 120 years ago.
So Fiona, I don't want to steal your question, but are you planning to talk to me about the structure of this novel at all?
No. Yes, of course. But you go ahead. You go ahead. What's your question? Go for it.
It's not so much a question as a statement, but as we are talking, I wanted to make it clear to readers that this is what we call a time jump story. The reason I know this is because we're the Outlander bookstore, so I have had to learn how these things are structured. So there is time travel. Then there is time jump when you have two different stories, but you go back and forth between 1906 and 2010. And then as with Outlander, you have time slip stories, which are completely different. And, you know, I think the structure is always so interesting depending on which of these you choose to tell your story. And when you're doing time jump, how do you manage, you know, the time that you, in the narrative that you allot to 1906 and then the modern, because we're not really talking about the modern story, but the modern story is a major part of the book.
So the modern story is, I sort of saw you as more than a framing story, but maybe less than an equal story. I mean, part of it I think is because I don't have to explain the history of 2010 to modern readers. I don't have to tell them what it was like to live in 2010, you know. And so there's not as much painting, you know, in the modern story about just the ordinary things of a streetcar or a tin horn on New Year's Eve or that sort of thing. But to me, the reason I like to write that way, and all of my novels have been like that, is I'm fascinated by the way the past and the present interact with each other, and especially with regard to books and stories, how the books and the stories of our past and our grandparents' past and our great-great-great-grandparents' past affect us, and also how those books and stories affect different generations in different ways. So I love doing things, for instance, like having Robert in 2010 occupying the same space that one of my characters occupied in 1906. Whether that's a particular library or, you know, like they all, I think, spend time in the New York Public Library main branch at one point. I'm surprised they don't run into some of Fiona's characters while they're there. We should definitely, you know, do a little crossover fan fiction or something. But I love that because it tells us about stories, it tells us about people, and it also, I think, is a commentary on what a city is and how a city is, I think New York is a character in this book, really, how a city is moving through history and, you know, that I can step into a space in the New York Public Library and be in the same space that really doesn't look that different than it did to William Howard Taft when he snuck in the front door to dedicate it in 1911, or to, you know, characters both real and imagined in Fiona's books and in other literature. So I like that sort of looking forward, looking backward, both in terms of stories, but also in terms of setting when you're in a city like New York. And especially, you know, not every modern reader has been to New York City, but pretty much every modern reader, you know, has at least seen a movie or a television show that's set in New York City and has a sense of what they feel New York is like. And it's fun to look at 1906 and say, okay, how is it, was it the same then? And how is it radically different? And allowing us to imagine, and you know, there are things in 1906 like the library, you know, is not there yet. It opens in 1911. So when they see it, it's brand spanking new. And to us, it's like this old, beautiful, old antique building, you know, but to them, it was the most modern thing in town, you know.
And speaking of the dual timelines, how did you write it? Did you do the 1906 timeline first and then the modern one, or did you go back and forth?
So I mostly went back and forth. I kind of have a tendency on these books to sort of write what is pressing on my mind at the time and worry about how I'm going to intercut later on. Mm-hmm. So I have, my editors will tell you, I think on most of my books, I don't think this happened with First Impressions, but with most of my books, the first editorial thing I get is you're cutting back and forth too often, you know, because that's, I'm just ADD. I'll go, I want this to happen. Okay. I'm over here. Now I'm over here. And so I end up, you know, pasting scenes together and editing it together. The first scene, I do remember that the first scene I wrote on this book was the General Slocum scene, because mm-hmm. I was actually on book tour with my previous book. I was in Southern Pines and I had an event late the night before in Fayetteville. And so I came into Southern Pines, spent the night, and then I had an early morning event and then I had a late afternoon event. So I had the whole day. And they have this really cool old house there that is run by a society, a literary society, and they have these rooms upstairs that are for writers. And so I spent the whole day in one of these rooms and I knew, well, I got to do the Slocum thing. So, I mean, I probably only wrote a couple of pages because I was doing, as I said, a lot of research as I went. But that's where I started. And that scene now is, I don't know exactly 40 or 50 pages into the book. So I didn't write it straight beginning to end. And as we worked on the editing, especially with my agent, we kept thinking it wasn't beginning in the right place. And so we altered where the book began a lot. So sometimes that meant moving scenes to the front. Sometimes it meant writing new material in the front and cutting some things out. So it went through several phases.
And at the heart of the book is this kind of unrequited love triangle, as well as a very guilt-ridden father-son relationship. And both are really heartbreaking. And I'm curious if you could talk about that, kind of the heart, the meat of the novel and where that came from.
Yeah, I think it's a good question where it came from. Maybe I should get a psychiatrist to tell me where it came from. Because, you know, it's funny, before talking to you today, I thought, oh gosh, I haven't read this novel in a long time. I don't have time to read it. I'm supposed to talk to Fiona in like 45 minutes. And so I just kind of flipped through and I would read the first few sentences of each chapter and go, okay, I remember what happens in that chapter. And even doing that, I felt, you know, emotional about it. I do think it's probably the most emotional novel that I've written. I don't have a good reason why. It may be that when you start with a tragedy where a character loses family members in this horrible accident, that you are going to go on with a level of sensitivity or something to those emotions. I'm really not sure. And I think part of it is, it's part of it's Magda. You know, sometimes your characters just get to you. And yeah. I love all four of these characters in different ways. But Magda, you know, you said that Magda is your favorite character. To me, Magda was the character who I was like, I want her to succeed so much. And I know that the world that she lives in makes it very difficult for an independent woman to succeed, you know, in the early 20th century. And there was just something about the things that she had been through, I think, that were very emotional for me. And there's a sentence in the book that as I was working draft by draft, every time I would get to this sentence, it wouldn't necessarily tear up, but it would just hit me on a gut emotional level. And it took me like 10 times of that happening for me to realize that this sentence was telling me, hey, Charlie, I'm the last sentence in your book. And so once I put that as the last sentence of the book, I think it really kind of brought a lot of these things that we're talking about together. I hope we'll leave the reader in a place where they realize that, because it is to a certain extent, it's a book about moving on after tragedy. I hope it'll bring the reader in a place, not where the reader feels heartbroken, but where the reader feels that heartbreak does not have to be something that ruins the rest of your life.
Yes, it transcends heartbreak, definitely. And speaking of that, you know, the flu of 1918 is mentioned in the book. And yes. I'm curious if your research into it affected the way you dealt with COVID and the quarantine this past year, and also regarding, you know, how to survive tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, this has been an interesting year for me, and it's been a year that has made me look at this book in different ways. Right before COVID happened, my father passed away. And so there, you know, as you said, Robert and his father have this this troubled relationship. And I didn't have a troubled relationship with my father. But when I look back on the book, you can't help but have that color the way I look at the book now, because, you know, my dad was a great supporter of my work. But I also know that what might be the lesson of this book, which I mentioned before, which is that heartache, pain, tragedy, personal loss can be with us for the rest of our lives without destroying or overbearing us for the rest of our lives. We can live with those things without having them control us. And I learned that from my dad, because my mom died when I was 2 years old. He was 29 years old and his wife was 29 years old, and she died of breast cancer. And by watching the way he lived the rest of his life, I learned that, because I knew that he was never not grieving for her, but he also never allowed that grief to keep him from having a happy and productive life for the next 57 years after her death.
Yeah. That is so inspiring. He sounds like he was an incredible man.
He was a good guy. Yeah, he was the guy who got me interested in all this stuff, because he was an English professor and a book collector. So all this, everything you see behind you, that's partly his fault.
I'm sure he was very proud of you with everything that you've accomplished. Libraries play a very important part in this book, and I'm curious how libraries and librarians influenced you as a writer and as a reader.
You know, all my novels have had libraries in them somewhere. It wasn't on purpose until about the third one, when I started to realize that I had libraries in all the book, and I thought, what other kinds of libraries could I have? And so The Lost Book of the Grail is about a cathedral library in England. And then I started giving talks to librarians, and I'm like, these people are fantastic. And when you stand up and you go, look, I've written novels that have libraries, they like you. But this one, to me, like, if it was gonna be about New York, and I, you know, there's always some element of books in my stories, how could it not encompass the amazing libraries of that city? Libraries in which I have worked frequently. I mean, your novel is, your main character is the curator of the Byrd Collection at the New York Public Library. I've worked in the Byrd Collection, back in the 80s, you know, and you and I both have descriptions of that Byrd Collection reading room in our novel, which in some ways is a room that's the antithesis of what you think of as the New York Public Library, because it's a sort of cozy little room. But then the branch libraries. And then, you know, when I found out that the library in Kleine Deutschland in the Lower East Side in the early part of the 20th century was the earliest free library in New York City and is still a branch of the New York Public Library. And if you go to that building, it still says in the brick on the front, it still says Freie Bibliothek in German, you know, free library. Just the variety of libraries in New York. And then one of my other favorite libraries that made it in to the book is, my wife and I were in New York one spring, and they had this thing called, it's something like Open House New York. And it's sponsored by the Architectural Society. And they have all these buildings in New York that are not normally open to the public that are open. And you can go in, it's oh, it was fantastic. So we just picked two or three buildings that weren't too far from where we were. And one of them was the Mechanics Institute Library on, I think it's on 44th Street. And from the outside, you would just walk right past this building and not even notice it. And you go in and it's just this amazing old fashioned library with these great creaky book carts and, you know, and a card catalog, like, yeah, it's a card catalog. And so I thought, oh, this has got to go. Cause I mean, that walking into that room, you really felt like you were walking into 1906, honestly. I mean, it feels like it hasn't really changed that much. And so I thought, well, that library has got to go into it. Well, so there's, I think there are 1, 2, 3, at least 4 different branches of the New York Public Library in this book, plus the Mechanics Library. I couldn't do what I do without libraries as somebody who writes historical novels. I mean, all the research that I mentioned all came from libraries and archives and museums, not from, you know, books in my own collection or newspapers and magazines in my own collection. So I am tremendously indebted to libraries and librarians. And it's nice to explore the ways in which libraries have affected all of us, not just in the preservation and distribution of knowledge, but in so many other ways.
Absolutely. And thank you to Barbara for matching us so well with our love of libraries.
I know, it's good. We need to write a book together or something. I was sort of surprised when, because so Fiona sent me very kindly sent me the NetGalley of her book, and I thought, well, you know, I'll read a chapter or two to get. Well, that was it. I sat down and read the whole thing pretty much cover to cover, and the whole time I kept thinking, how have we not met yet?
I know,
because like we have so much in common. Like I know people who are in your, the one in real test of how well you're going to get along with an author is when you read their acknowledgments and people that you know personally are in their acknowledgments, you're like, yes. Okay, good. We're good to go.
Yeah.
One of our very favorite things to do here is sell authors' books to other authors or match up authors. And I think we're actually pretty good at it. You two seem like a star-crossed pair for sure. Patrick is over here. Let me just interrupt and see if he has some questions or comments that he'd like to forward from the audience.
Not really.
No?
Everybody's just watching. And the one question, Charlie, that has been asked by several people, you've mainly gone over, which is basically, do you write the stories one at a time or concurrently?
Yeah, I mean, I think for this, with there being so much historical research, I felt like there were going to be these sort of history moments along the way, the Slocum scene, the Dreamland scene, some of these things. And so sometimes I would sort of figure, okay, how do I get from this scene to the next scene? And I would write the in-between bits, you know, but I write it more in order than not in order. But I like it when I get to those history moments, because I'm like, okay, now I have, you know, the New York Times and the New York, all these newspapers and magazines to help me. I'm not like swimming on my own, making up every single thing. And in fact, there are in several places in the novel, in the Slocum scene and in some of Tom's newspaper articles, there are places where I would use sentences or even 2 or 3 sentences in a row that are taken right out of the press accounts at the time, which was, for me, it was a fun way to be sure that my language, the way I was using language, was in sync with the way language was being used at the time, was pull a few of those sentences in. And if they seem really jarring, then I know I don't quite have it right. But if I read back through it a month later and I can't remember which sentences are mine and which ones are stolen, then I knew I did a pretty good job, you know.
And speaking of that, I love, you know, the attention to detail and even in your inventive chapter headings for the older timeline. So there's one, San Francisco, when the West was still wild. And another is New York City, when ladies danced on the roof. And how did you come up with this? I thought it's brilliant because it places you in a different period without saying, okay, it's, you know, New York City, 1912.
So, That was sort of my agent's idea. She said, have you thought about maybe chapter titles? And I started playing around with it. And I thought, well, maybe instead of titles, you know, these little, you gave a couple of good examples. And so I would just look through the chapter and try to pull out something that seemed to sort of capture the essence of it that could be worded in a way that almost felt like the title of a book from that time period. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when the West was still wild, you know, the fact that Enrico Caruso, the great Italian tenor, when he went to San Francisco in 1906 and was there during the earthquake, famously carried a six shooter with him because he was convinced that he would need it on the streets of San Francisco, you know, or the, you know, the fact that one of the great things I discovered about New York in that time period was all the Broadway theaters and Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden, they had theaters on the roof because they didn't have any air conditioning. And so in the summertime, it was much too hot to pack 2,000 people into a room with lights and everything, you know. And so they would have these shows on open air theaters up on the roof, and at one of these, a very famous historical event happened that shows up, yeah, in the novel. But but I just loved that. So I liked those little surprising moments, or those moments that sort of seemed to where you could get a sense of the history of the moment in just a few words. You know, I can't remember the one. About, because there's a scene where each of our three historical heroes experience New Year's Eve 1899, which was the place to go in New York in 1899 was not Times Square, although it was Longacre Square in those days, but was Trinity Churchyard, which is where you go now. Everybody goes to see the tomb of Alexander Hamilton. And if you look closely, Hercules Mulligan is there too, by the way. And so, you know, and they all blew these tin horns. Well, the first thing, I started writing this and all of a sudden I thought, that's the meaning of the first song in Guys and Dolls, Fugue for Tin Horns. I never really knew what that meant, you know. So there were all these moments of discovery, and it was fun to sort of distill those down into three or four words, as I don't even think of them as chapter titles, but sort of as chapter headings for those historical chapters. And then it sort of sets them apart from the, yes, from the more contemporary chapters, where the heading just is the location. So it'll say, you know, Central Park or public library, or, you know, wherever, right, where the chapter happens to take place.
Oh, it's just a really inventive way, because as an author, you're always trying to figure out how to ground the reader in the next timeline. And solve it.
You know, my first novel, The Bookman's Tale, when it was submitted, it just went back and forth, and it had three timelines. And my editor's like, I kind of think you got to put dates on here, or people are going to be so confused that, you know. And so I had accepted that reality, that you can't just let people figure it all out on their own. And but it's nice to find a way to do that that seems to fit a particular novel, rather than just saying, as you said, 1906 or something. And to me, that sort of old-fashioned wording seemed to work well. And it also seemed to fit the old-fashioned style of writing of children's series books.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I enjoyed more than anything else in writing this book is there are a few excerpts from the series books that my fictional characters write. So these books don't really exist. Mm-hmm. So I would write a few paragraphs of, you know, the first chapter of Alice Gold, Girl Inventor, yeah, or the first chapter of Dan Dawson, Circus Star, you know, and that was great fun to do that, to try to capture that slightly naive, overly wordy, you know, style of writing children's books that was popular at that time.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's,
yes, another question. So hang on here.
Okay, so the question is, have you thought about writing more of the tremendous trio stories that are shared in the book?
It's a great question.
Our three characters who are writing three separate children's books end up writing a crossover series called The Tremendous Trio, which stars Dan Dawson, who is a circus star who always is in the right place to help out in a disaster. Alice Gold, who is a girl inventor. Gene very much wanted his hero to be a girl. And Frank Fairfax, who is a cub reporter who goes to mostly fictional places. I think he goes to El Dorado in the first book. And so the idea is that these three characters would get together and have really grand adventures. And I liked it for a lot of reasons. One is that it was a new idea. Like in that time period, they weren't doing crossovers. I'm sure there have been, you know, in the later years, in the 80s and 1980s and 90s, I'm sure there were crossovers with, I remember TV crossovers with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, but they just didn't do that at that time. So I thought it'd be really cool to have my characters think up something new like that. But yeah, it was really fun to write those pieces. I don't think I will sit down and write the whole Tremendous Trio book, because I'll say, as an author, it's both easier and more fun to say to your reader, the adventure they have is grander than anything they had had before. Like, if I write the whole book, I got to think that up. But it's more fun to let you think it up and let it be part of your imagination as a reader. You know, I really believe that writing a novel is the first half of a creative act, and that the second half is when you read it. And every person who reads that will imagine a different adventure for the Tremendous Trio. And so everyone will have a different experience with the book. So I love putting sort of teasers in there, a first chapter here and there, but allowing my readers to decide, you know, what adventures they really do go on.
So Fiona, this would be a great time to ask you, tell us a couple of books that you read as a child, whether they were a series or standalones, that really influenced you.
Sure. You know, definitely Nancy Drew. Definitely. Cherry Ames, Student Nurse.
Oh, yeah.
The Little House books. Absolutely. I was living out west when I was reading those. So, you know, just the sense of mountains and prairies I could relate to. And then, you know, Where the Red Fern Grows. Such a beautifully sad book. And then, those were kind of the ones that I would read over and over and over. And that really kind of affected me as a very young girl.
So my mother was a terrific reader, and she had saved many of her childhood books. She was born in 1917, so we're talking about books in the 20s. So I used to go and read the Bobbsey Twins. There's a raft of the Bobbsey Twins.
That's a Stratemeyer series.
Yep. And my very favorite, and I've always loved this, I've always remembered this line, there was a series called The Motor Girls back when cars were new and, you know, women weren't really driving. So they were probably, gosh, they might have been written in the teens or maybe the early 1920s.
So.
But my very favorite was a book called The Motor Girls Tour New England. And the line that I loved in it, partly because of the rhyme, scorching along at 22, they blew a shoe, which, you know, was a word for tire that they used then. And I just love that. Scorching along at 22, they blew a shoe. And that started the adventure, you know, because it was the accident that derailed them. And, you know, they needed to be derailed to go off on things. And the other thing I love, do you remember the little big books, Charlie? Did you run
across? Oh, yeah. I didn't have those as a child, but I have it behind me because Alice in Wonderland was published as a little big book. So I have one on a shelf back there someplace.
Well, my uncle had a sterling collection and he went off to war. I was born in 1940, so I didn't really read all that well until he came back. But he had saved all his little big books when he packed up and went off to be a soldier in India. And my favorite was Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon and the Evil Emperor Ming and Princess Aurora. And, you know, I'm telling you that I believe that, you know, we could travel to other planets and so forth when I was just a little kid, because I was convinced that Flash Gordon and the planet Ming were real.
It fascinated me to find out that not only nowadays, but at the time, librarians and teachers were really opposed to these children's series books because they, you know, they were considered to be trashy and poorly written and they didn't have, you know, and I think the equivalent today is probably something like Dave Pilkey, you know, like Captain Underpants and these things, that because they're books that would draw a reluctant reader into the joy of reading. And to me, I'm not going to argue that the Hardy Boys or the Motor Girls or any of these are great literature, but I think they have a great cultural significance because they drew generations of American kids into being excited about reading rather than being forced to read.
You know? No, I think you're right. It was really the Oz books were my passion. I read them all and I was absolutely convinced that I would go to Oz. And in fact, the moment when I realized that things didn't always come true, and that I think it was my first brush with mortality was when I recognized when I was something like 10 that I would never get to click my heels together and go over the deadly desert. and land in Oz, because I really believed it was possible. Yeah. Until this moment. The other comment I would make too, and I, you know, we've talked a bit about gender, but I hardly ever talk to a girl who read the Hardy Boys, and I hardly ever talk to a boy who's read Nancy Drew. And I do think that the more modern versions of this, as you were suggesting, are not not gender related. But, you know, Fiona, did you know girls who read the Hardy Boys? I never did.
You know, my brother read them, so I would pick one up every so often. But no, it was definitely along gender lines.
And it certainly, really, you know, Stratemeyer marketed them that way. And you know, I have in my book, my fictional editor or publisher has been publishing these series books for boys, and has to be talked into the idea that he could publish them for girls as well. There were a lot more of them for boys than there were for girls, because they were these, they were formulaic, and they were these adventure stories where people got into physical danger, and, you know, girls weren't supposed to read that sort of thing. They were supposed to read about sewing, and, you know, and so I think that that's, we don't have nearly as much gender separation, I think, in books that are being written for children now, than what there was then. Yeah.
Right, you remind me of Tom Swift, for example. There's another one, you know, where he's sort of your version of the girl who was the engineer. We had Tom Swift.
There was always supposed to be, I think they were supposed to be in peril, like at least every three chapters or something. I mean, there are all these rules that, and they couldn't, you know, like boys and girls couldn't hold hands or display affection, and they couldn't, there's no drinking and or smoking or cursing or any of those things, you know, not to mention all the things that we have in children's books now that they didn't have in those, like there was no vampires or zombies or, you know. But for me, it was, I think one of the books that got me started, other than the Hardy Boys that were on my brother's shelf, so therefore they were like, ooh, it's my brother's things, I can steal them. But my parents brought me a copy of The Hobbit, and I just set it aside because my parents had recommended it to me, so therefore, you know, I shouldn't read it. And then I like to listen to the radio late at night under the covers, and I was listening to the local public radio station, and there was this story that was on the radio, and I just got like really, really into it. Like, people were stuck in spider webs, and at the end they said, and that's the latest episode of The Hobbit. And I like started tearing my room apart trying to find the book, because I had come in, you know, right in the middle. And that was one that I, for many years as a teenager, we spent our summers up in the mountains, and I would just start every summer by reading that book, you know. Mm-hmm.
So Fiona, did you have any questions that we short-circuited?
No, you know, I was just curious to know what's next, or what are you working on?
I am working on, I mean, I'm actually done with a draft of a novel that's a little bit less bookish than my other novels, although the main character is a librarian. So, but it's your standard small town librarian and professional assassin try to solve 75-year-old Nazi secret/mystery, you know.
Oh, that sounds great.
It's a little bit more of a thriller than what I've done before, but it's been really fun. It was really kind of inspired by multiple visits to Bletchley Park and a fascination with the Enigma machine. And I had a good friend, if you can see behind me, you may not be surprised to know that I'm in the Lewis Carroll Society. And I had a good friend who was in that society named Mavis Beatty, who it turns out was not only at Bletchley, but was one of the key code breakers at Bletchley. And she never talked about it much because you weren't supposed to. But you know, we knew Mavis pretty well and had lovely conversations with her. And then after her death, we were at a literary festival in England, and they were doing a panel about women in World War II, and somebody got up and said, well, the two women were responsible for the Allies winning World War II, and one of them was such and such a spy, and the other one was Mavis Beatty. And Janice and I just almost fell out of our chairs. And so I think at that point I thought, I've got to write something where Enigma plays a role. So this new novel's Enigma plays a role.
That sounds great. That sounds great.
Fiona, what are you working on now that The Lions of Fifth Avenue has come out a month or two back? What's your next historical research project?
The next book will be set at the Frick Collection, which is which is a real gem of a building that was Henry Clay Frick's residence and then became a museum, and two timelines and the element of mystery, and we'll see how it goes. It's a beautiful building to work in. And luckily it's the floor plans are online and virtual, so I can do a 360 degree tour of each room, which is very helpful in this time when you can't get there.
Yeah.
There yourself.
That's so exciting. Well, I can hardly wait for your, we'll have to do this again when when you manage to publish. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful hour. It's just so much fun and very informative. Patrick, was there anything else that anyone wanted to ask before we sign off?
Just the last question. Tell us about that Morris chair back there. Is that a Stickley?
That is a Stickley. Yeah. My wife and I live in a house that was built in 1970 with a hodgepodge of architectural influences. And we have spent the last about 15 years trying to beat it into submission to become an arts and crafts home. But I am up in my writing studio right now, which was actually an add-on. So this is only about 10-year-old construction. And if you see the built-ins, I literally just showed my carpenter a piece of Stickley furniture and said, make it look like that. And they did a fantastic job. So in front of me is the view out into our back garden. So I've been stuck here for 6 months, but it's a nice place to be stuck. So
yeah. It's wonderful. And Fiona has a very handsome office and thoughtfully has got your books side by side up there.
Yeah,
she's got the Lion of Fifth Avenue. And yeah. Escaping Dreamland, which look wonderful together. Thank you so much for a wonderful evening. And I want to thank all of you who've been watching us this evening. Don't forget that Charlie's book, Escaping Dreamland, which you can't possibly resist now, will be with us very shortly in autographed copies. And feel free to recommend the video and the coming podcast for this wonderful hour to your friends. Good night. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.